Welcome to the Junior MBA Coaches Corner with your host, Jay Billis. Today, Jay welcomes Michigan State head coach Tom Izzo and Dallas Mavericks assistant coach Jamal Mosley. And now, here's your host, Jay Billis.
We'd like to welcome all of you to the latest episode of Junior NBA Coaches Corner, the podcast that brings in some of the greatest basketball minds in the game to talk about the most important issues in the game. And today we're going to talk about teaching and building your defense. And we have two spectacular guests. I'm going to introduce them both. We've got Jamal Mosley and Tom Izzo. First of all, Jamal Mosley of the Dallas Mavericks. He's been an assistant coach with Dallas for the last 5 years, but has also been with the Cleveland Cavaliers and the Denver Nuggets. He's right now the defensive coordinator for the Dallas Mavericks, and he was an outstanding player at the University of Colorado, where he scored over 1,000 points his last couple of years, averaged over 14 points and 6 rebounds per game. So he's done it not only on the sidelines, but was also an outstanding player. And we're also fortunate to have with us Tom Izzo, the head coach at Michigan State, who has taken the Spartans not only to a national championship in the year 2000, but to 8 Final Fours. He's in the Naismith Basketball Hall of Fame. And he also was an outstanding player, Division II All-American in 1977 at Northern Michigan, where I think he still holds some sort of record for having 14 assists in a single game, which I find kind of hard to believe. But if it says it, it must be true. Did you really have 14 assists, or did guys, you should have had 20 and your teammates missed like 6 shots they should have had?
Yeah, one of my teammates was Mike Garland, who's now my assistant, so I'd blame it on him every day. But I think there were some lies. But at Northern Michigan, you know, we just got computers a couple of years ago, so I don't know how they kept those stats.
Yeah, I think they're written on a stone tablet somewhere, but we'll find them later on. But we are going to talk about teaching and building your defense. But before we get into it, I wanted to start sort of with a premise. While we're talking about defense, I believe, and I think both of you believe, and I'll get you to comment on this, is that all of the aspects of the game, whether it's offense, defense, communication, all the different systems you may have, are interconnected, and they affect every other aspect. So, for example, if you run poor offense, you take bad shots, you turn the ball over, that is going to have a direct effect on your defense. And so I'd like you to talk about the interconnection of offense, defense, and communication. Jamal, I'll start with you on the NBA level. You don't want to have people think that these are compartmentalized. Every aspect of the game affects every other aspect of the game. Would you agree with that, and could you expound on it?
Jay, that's so true. I was just, you know, going over notes last night and talking to some friends. That's the exact way it's supposed to be run. Like, your good offense leads to good defense. We have a category, essentially, in our programming when we do breakdowns of games, and we have catastrophic turnover, because now you have nothing that you can do with the defense. So if you toss it over, hand it out of bounds, whatever, now you can't get your defense set. If you have good offense and guys know where shots are coming from, now they know the exact way that they're falling back in transition. You can get your defense set, and now everybody understands where they're supposed to be on the floor, whether that ball comes up the sideline or the middle of the floor. At least it allows the positioning and the balance of your defense to get set.
Tom, do you look at it the same way and communicate it to your players about the interconnection between offense and defense and communication?
You know, I do, Jay. And like Jamal said, you know, I think I'll look at it the opposite way. Good defense usually means you're in better position to rebound, which means you're in better position to fast break. And so I try to sell them that if we defend better and rebound better, everybody wants to play fast break basketball. So our running game is better. So I think we're good offense, helps create a better defensive flow and numbers. I think good defense helps not put you in a position where you're helping so much that you give up rebounding. But most important for us, we can get clean rebounds and good defense, and we can get our fast break going. So I try to sell the break with the defense to get them to play, because as Jamal knows, it's hard to get guys to play defense, man. They all wanted that offensive stats. And Jay, nobody was better at the offensive stats than you. So we
got two good I don't think guys. It was offense. I think it was just offensive. I think it was just offensive, not offensive. But let me put you, Tom, in the position first of say today you were walking into East Lansing in the Michigan State program. You were starting from scratch today, and we're talking about building your defense. What would you emphasize and how would you go about putting in your defensive system and your defensive values?
Well, our values are a little different than some because I don't get into the lanes in that. We're playing more what I call help defense. And for the most part, we've always got elbows and blocks covered with people we're going against. When we played Zion Williamson, the deal was, it wasn't the Jordan rules as Chuck Daly had, but it was, he should see six eyes every time he touches the ball. That doesn't mean we're double teaming or triple teaming him. He just should see six people having an idea. I kind of like to do that with everybody. In other words, our help defense is a key. So I don't force baseline or middle. I try to keep guys in front of me all the time. And by keeping in front of me, we're squared up here. We're helping them. Now, we'll cheat. Guy's better with his left hand or right hand. We'll cheat on that. But for the most part, we don't force baseline or necessarily force middle because I think that's what people are looking to do. They're looking to drive and kick in the new offenses. And driving kicks mean you get open shots, you get people out of position. So the best thing I'm selling early is keep the damn ball in front of you.
So the player guarding the ball, keep it in front of you. And then as to your help, you mentioned the elbow and the block. You're going to position help on the elbow and the block. And then are they moving as the ball moves? Is that a big emphasis to reposition help?
Yeah, I'm saying elbow and block, thinking that the ball's on the wing. If
on the wing.
Ball's at the top of the key, it's elbow and elbow. In other words, there's always that triangle that we're trying to form where a guy never has a free rein to catch the ball and just drive it. And so everybody, every time a ball's passed, we're talking about jumping to the ball. You know, we're not talking about just denying. And everybody does it differently. And I have a lot of respect for the people that deny passing lanes. And I just think I tried denying because that was my personality. But I realized as the game went on, people quit doing that. And you usually win games at the end of the game, not at the beginning of the game, it seems like. So I wanted to do something that stressed my personality, which is good defense, but also understood the players and how they're going to play. So we're always jumping to the ball. We're always moving as the ball moves. And all five guys should be moving, you know. And it'll be interesting. Like Jamal, you know, in the NBA where it seems like, first of all, I envy you because the NBA, you know, when you're a college guy or college players, they all say, oh, they don't play any defense. You know, the average fan, they just roll the ball out. When you study the NBA, you realize how hard they play. Just the players they're playing against are so damn good. But in the NBA, I'd be interested to see what you do as far as the initial, you know, are you forcing them all the time or are you playing them head up?
That's a great question. So we've transitioned over time, like you're saying, guys are so good and you can't really give them an angle. We've gone from, you know, forcing the ball to the sideline and pick and roll and keeping it down. But we've gone more towards these past couple of years to just square it up, like you said. Don't let them beat you. And our philosophy is five guys on a string. You know, when the ball moves, you move. We try to eliminate the paint and the three. That's the one thing. You're not going to stop guys from shooting threes. So then I think that gets back to closeouts and whatnot. But we want to eliminate the paint, which is the layup, which is the easiest shot. And then you want to eliminate the wide open three. So we force guys into that tough two range. When it comes to how we started, I really like to start out transitionally. I think the first thing we always do is just kind of, it works on your offense and your defense when we're building it. Work on transition first because it forces guys to communicate. It forces guys to get out of their comfort zone a little bit and figure out how they got to just stop the ball, get back, protect the paint along with those rules. That's kind of how we build it up. But the closeouts, we've gone truly to just keep them in front of you to your ability. That's the biggest thing for us, position defense with your ability.
Well, and if I could add to that, Jay, you know, that's what I found interesting in my NBA friends. I mean, it's like giving up a corner three is almost like college giving up a layup. I mean, you can do anything. Am I right on this? But don't give up a corner three, you know?
So true.
And I thought that was interesting. But I did enjoy, too, because we tried it. Call it what you want, icing it, turning it down, red, black, whatever color you want to use, turning down those side ball screens. And we found that the good guards just have a way to snake their way around that, boy, and it's pretty hard. You know, We looked at covering ball screens on shacking it or not. I call it shack and staying back. Boy, that became better guards found a way to navigate that. And that's why I've kind of stayed with the head up a little bit more.
Jamal, let me follow up just for a minute on closeouts, the idea of closing out to shooters. And you mentioned, you know, it can vary based upon the ability level of the defender, but it's also based upon the scouting report on the shooter, correct? Like, how do you handle closeouts, and what techniques do you use? Do you use flybys, or is it always just you're going to close out to take away shot and drive?
So we're never going to use the flyby, only because it takes you out of position. I think you're always going to, if we're closing out and it's a knockdown shooter, say you have Clay, you have Steph, you have, you know, Seth here, you're closing to the body as much as you can just to get them to put the ball on the ground. I don't believe in the flyby because it takes you out of position. It puts your defense in rotation. And now you're playing basically 4-on-5. So it's best if we can close to the body, make him put it on the floor. And again, we have great shooters. So you're making him put the ball on the floor and take away the three initially. And then at least your defense is ready and set, and you know where you're forcing him. So you get to his body first just to make him put the ball on the ground.
And Tom, how do you look at closeouts?
You know, I'm almost identical. I've never used a flyby. I know some coaches that have. But I agree, Jamal, you know, my whole philosophy is keeping it inside out. And that's why the jump to the ball stuff and being on the string, because – why you give up a corner three, if you ask me, is if they penetrate because you flew by them and then you're out of position on the help guy. And so now you got to take an extra step to help and you'll never get back to the shooter. So the philosophies are almost identical, that don't give up penetration, because penetration leads to an easier shot, an easier kick out, or heaven forbid, a tough shot. And now guys are out of position, so they're dunking the rebound. So I think we've been one of the better rebounding teams, Jay, as you know, on this for 20 years. And I think we're not always the biggest team. And everybody says, well, you must, you know, we do a little war drill. We do this and that. And it's all true. But really what people don't see is we rebound well because we don't give up a lot of penetration. And that's kind of, I think, the key to a good rebounding team.
Jamal, can you talk about the difference between good help and over help?
That's a great one, because we've had this discussion a ton, trying to figure out when you go and not go. And I think that's part of five guys being on a string. You know, let's just say we're on the wing and you get beat towards the baseline. And usually there should be someone on the baseline coming across the lane to help. Well, if that defender is good enough to just veer him outside to where it's not a straight line drive, that weak side defender should be able to understand when I come across and not come across. So mind you, if it's a blow by, I have to go. And that's part of the closeout. That's being able to contain the ball. So I think when you overhelp, it's creating the exact problem that the offense wants. They want to get you moving faster, rotating when you don't need to. So I think if a guy can work on, again, keeping the ball in front, that's the communication. So if I see I'm on a guy's hip and he's driving to the lane, usually that man's not coming across the lane for help if not necessary, just to veer him outside of the straight line drive.
Tom, do you feel the same way? It's sort of, I've always, from a just an outsider's view, from the sidelines, that the best defenses I see are the ones that help the least. Not that they're not there to help, but they don't have to help as much. And then overhelp seems to get teams in more trouble than anything when they perhaps help when they don't have to, or they overhelp when the primary defender's already recovered, and then they get burned as a result of it on a pass out.
Yeah, that's where those 3-point kick out, ready shoot shots, as I call them. But I think you know, like Jamal, it's preventative management over crisis management. If you're in the right position, if you're on that string, if you're in your help early, he doesn't usually get the straight line drive. You know, I always say more than one guy is guarding the ball. Now we have to be able to move on the pass, not on the catch. I think a lot of people, a guy passes the ball, guy looks and then moves to his man. I think you got to move the minute it leaves his hand. So we talk about a lot about moving on the pass, not on the catch. And I think that helps that. But blow-bys are impossible to stop. You know, blow-bys, I think in the NBA, I think I'd rather give up the two than the three. In college, we can cheat it both ways because there's not as many good 3-point shooters. But, yeah, blow-by is – you know, you better replace the guy he's blown by unless he is Steph Curry, then you got to live with it.
You know, Tom, you mentioned moving on the flight of the ball. And I know Tony Bennett, Virginia, calls that airtime. Do you talk to your team about anticipating the pass, or do you tell them, hey, wait until the pass is thrown and then move on the flight of the ball? How do you handle that?
I do talk about anticipating it within general, but what I mean by that is be down in your stance ready to move. You know, most people, when they're off the ball, whether we like it or not, they get lazy. You know, there's nothing – Jamal used the word on a string. There's nothing like seeing five guys moving. When a pass is made, if everybody's doing their job right at Michigan State, five guys should move some. Five guys should all move some. I don't care if it's the center. I don't care guarding a post. I don't care if it's a wing. Everybody moves some. And we like to say, if you're two passes away, try to have a foot in the paint. Now, the reason we do that is there should be enough pressure on the ball that they can't straight line the pass to the opposite wing. But if there's no pressure on the ball, now those straight line passes and you're dead that way too. So I deal a lot with preventative management. Be in the right position early and you won't have to be coming to help late and then trying to get back to your man.
You know, Jamal, on that point, you know, it's been mentioned that more than one player is playing, guarding the ball. And so let me ask you about this concept, the idea that all five defenders are playing the ball and their positioning is based on the ball. Is that something you deal with in the NBA and you teach?
Very true. That's exactly how we teach it. So like Coach Izzo said, inside to out. So if the ball is on the far wing again, every person should know where they should be. And if that ball goes to the middle, I know how far I'm coming up the floor to help or not help. If it goes baseline, I know how far I'm coming across the lane. Because there's going to be blowbys. There's going to be guys getting beat. The guys in the league are just way too good. But it really is five guys on a string. Like, we have our rules set in place of where you're helping from, where you're not helping from. Guys understand, you know, and that's how we can correct the mistakes. Because when guys do it, you're like, that's not our rule. You know, and then so guys are going to get beat. Guys are going to get broken down. But you have to understand, we know whose responsibility it is in any given situation, depending on where that ball goes.
And, you know, Jay, that's where college, high school, and pro ball can be a little bit different. For example, the spacing. I try to watch a ton of NBA games. I think they play the 90 games a year. They're the experts. And, I mean, I really do look at that. And the one thing that when I talk to my buddies in the league, it still comes down, they do the best job of anybody of spacing. And they have more room because of the wider three-point line. So it's even harder. You should have been the offensive coach. Defensive coach in the league is too hard. But being the defensive coach is harder because you have more spacing. And, boy, you give an incredible athlete with guard skills and the ability to shoot it. That's hard to guard in that league because they've got a couple more feet around than we do to try to maintain. And I think that's why I have so much respect for the way they do it and kind of learn from them, tweak it into how I can do it.
Yeah, Jamal, you'd mentioned before about, you know, your defense starting at transition. And it raised a question in my mind. So does that relate to, first and foremost, how many you send to the offensive glass?
It does. It definitely does. And we've had, like, there's been debates going on because obviously, you know, the numbers game and what you're willing to live with, what you're not willing to live with, how many you can get back. Like the old traditional, you know, you send three back that don't shoot, you know, and then two kind of, you know, one's crashing the glass, one's not. So we've gone, you know, on a different level because, you know, we can score here. But I believe that if you have the guys that can crash and get back, I think that's how you have to coach the team, I think, a little bit. Because if you have guys that are, you know, great offensive rebounders, you can't limit their ability to offensive rebound. But those guys usually that are very good offensive rebounders are usually motor guys. So their ability to crash the glass and get back, you can give them that leeway to go ahead and do it. Now, the guys that aren't, you just say, you know what, don't end up in no man's land. That shot goes up, get your tail back and protect our paint.
You know, and Tom, some of your teams in the past, you've sent four guys to the offensive glass and just said, okay, we'll race you back if you get the rebound. But you wanted the chance for those easy second shots. Is that something that you assess each year, based on your team, or is it something you just believe in that you're going to send 3-4 guys all the time?
You know, Jay, I do believe in it. And the reason for that was my way to be my personality. Let's be aggressive and go. Maybe it's not defensively, but, you know, back when I started, I had Charlie Bell, I had Jason Richardson, Morris Peterson. Those guys were phenomenal wing rebounders. We'd send 4 to the boards all the time. And the philosophy was a lot of 2 and 3 men are cheating out. And so then when they had to play us, they had to make a decision. Do we want to cheat out? And Dick Bennett would say, because we had Wisconsin, we played them 4 times a year, we won it. I always said Dick Bennett sent 5 guys back and he'd come off the bench and guard them. You know, he just did not want to give up a layup. And I said the opposite. You know, I think my aggressive 4 man to the board started causing teams to stay in that were running teams because they were afraid that if we get it. So I tell my guys, don't worry about getting back. Go to the boards. Then get back after. Then we played North Carolina my 3rd year when they had Vince Carter in them. So the first half, I said, I got so scared of their break, I said, I'm sending guys back. I was 15 down at halftime. And so second half, we changed, cut it to 3. But I think that's what Jamal said, that you can't change who you are. But I do make adjustments. And as you know, Jay, you cover a lot of our games. We're probably sending 3 religiously, but the aggression isn't the same. And I think part of that is me. I haven't done as good a job. You know, I call it being half pregnant. You're either pregnant or you're not. You either go or you don't go. When you half go, now you're not getting back and you're not going. And so Dick Bennett's philosophy was send everybody back, you know, which, you know, worked for him. They got to a Final 4. My philosophy sent everybody there. It worked for us. Now as you get different guys, and I thought what you said, Jamal, was really good. High motor guys, and I think we have a tendency to have less high motor guys, more skilled guys, less high motor guys. So I've adapted a little bit, or given in is a better word that I hate to use, to the modern day guy.
Jamal, how do you feel about both in the NBA and when you think about the game generally, double teams, not only a double team on a ball handler, maybe in a screen roll situation, but on doubling the post?
We've gone away from it, I think, because of what the game, what you're willing to give up. Because like you said, teams are shooting 40 to 50 threes and you're putting yourself in rotation. Now, even if your rotation is perfect, you're putting yourself in rotation for no apparent reason. So our word that we use is make them grind for 2s. You know, make them grind down there. Even if we have a mismatch, let's say we switch a big onto one of our guards, whether that's Seth or Tim, we let them battle. We teach our guys to be able to play one-on-one defense down there on the block just the same, so we don't have to help. You know, now if we have to help, he's grinding for that 2 where it's not just an easy layup. At least now it's a tough 2, and now we got to get now we can get out on the break and go. But double team, again, because of rotations, it becomes tough to do because you're putting yourself in scramble mode without needing to.
So it's basically extraordinary circumstances. Otherwise, you try to stay away from it?
We do. And if we can get away with it, like just if it's the ball's moving around the horn and to switch, we try to switch and kick. Like if we switch that small guy on and that big's over there and he can just run over and get that kick that guard out fast, then that we prefer that. But if he's down there, we're going to make sure our guards battle to make sure we're not ending up in rotation.
Tom, how about you in double teams? I remember my old boss used to, when double teams were brought up, he'd say, okay, the first question you have to ask when you're talking about a double team is how do you feel about open shots?
I agree with it. I've almost never double teamed. I do a little what I call digging in the post. Again, it's the wing. If the wing enters the post, he jumps to the ball just like he should everywhere else. Just dig enough, you know, to bother him, to let him know that somebody might be coming. But I've almost never double teamed. You know, I mean, it also depends a couple times, you know, if, again, I'll use Zion because he was just unguardable for a team like us. So we dug hard on him, but we never did double him. And it depends a little bit on the passer. You know, is that post guy a good passer or not? If he's not a very good passer, he's had 1 assist in the end of the season, you know, maybe we'll dig down a little harder. But never where we have to rotate. I agree 100% with that.
when you dig into the post, so say the ball goes into the post from the wing, and the defender, the wing defender, would open up and dig down on the post, as an example. When you dig down, do you dig down just to bother, or do you dig down to steal the ball?
Well, you know, we played Kentucky a few years ago when they were one in the country, and they did not have very good shooters. And so we dug down to try to get a steal because we knew the post player at the time wasn't going to give it up. And so then, you know, maybe to try to get a steal. We've always dug down and reached up because when you reach down, you're lunging toward the ball. When you reach up, you're kind of getting back to your man. So we try to reach up when we do it. But, you know, the one thing that I've noticed, there's not a lot of great post players in college. I'm not sure there are in pro ball either like it used to be. And everybody is more understanding of the three-point shot, even in college. So I think we're getting to the same mentality, you know, give up a two before you gave up a three. And the rotations take incredible communication. And unless we put, you know, phones on their belt buckles so they can text each other, how in the hell do you communicate?
Jamal, how do you look at that? When you guys, in the event that you would dig into the post, how do you dig? How do you go after the ball as to what Tom was talking about?
So similar to Coach Izzo, because that's the same thing. When you dig with the swipe down, you're lunging at the ball. So, and then we also worry about the jet cut, which is that baseline cut once that ball's entered. So now we've gone over discussions. Do I turn my body one way because I want to give up? I don't want to give up the middle. So if that ball's entered from the right wing to the right block, I'm sitting with my chest still facing that right sideline and I'm digging with my left hand on the ball up. And now if that guy cuts through, we're not digging. We're digging to disrupt more than digging to steal. So I'm just disrupting him. So I break that post player rhythm. And like Coach said, there's so many guys that depending on if he's a passer or if he's just, I'm a non-passer, like you said, with the one assist at the end of the year, then there's time that I'm going to disrupt a little bit more. But because guys are just posting in the NBA now just to pass, you just got to be a little bit more aware. So your help more is coming from the weak side than it is right in front of the ball.
And Jamal, what's your view on switching? When do you want to switch? When do you want to avoid it? Emergency situations, you name it. What's your view on switching?
I think it depends on game to game. I think that's a lot of game planning because there's teams that, you know, if they're a great, let's just say a 2-point shooting team and they're efficient, the Portlands, the Damian Lillards, the McCollums, like you don't want to get guys switched on guys like that because you know they're going to break you down and beat you with the two. So it just depends on the personnel in certain games because for rebounding, for positioning, everybody knows where they're supposed to be. So I think we base it game to game. We have a lot of like-size guys, so we can switch those positions. Try not to switch the small, and we try not to switch the five, man.
Tom, how do you view switching?
You know, I never used to switch much. And like he said, you know, we get a lot of picking and popping in our league. You know, four mans that can shoot it, that pick and pop. And it's pretty hard to cover if you don't switch it, if you ask me. Screen and rolls, you know, sometimes if you get a real good guard who can really dissect the screen and roll, we found it to be better switching. And we figured out, I heard Eddie Fogler speak 20 years ago at a clinic. And he said, what beats you more, you know, the mismatch or the open shot? And the open shot usually beats you more than the mismatch. But I don't like when you're rotating. And when we switch, like if a five sets a screen on a one and we're switching that for some reason, number one, I better have a guy like we have Xavier Tillman who can guard. If I had a guy like Nick Ward who wasn't really good moving his feet out there, I would do it differently. But we can switch that. And then when he rolls into the post and we got Cassius Winston on a big guy, we're trying to get a double switch from our wing guy to come in and just switch that out. But if you don't have to switch it, and again, it depends on the team, but it also depends on your team. If you got a bunch of 6'4 to 6'8 guys, then it's easier. If you got a true point guard and a big center that can't move, then I think it's more difficult.
Tom, how about screen roll situations? And let's start with side pick and rolls. Do you have a preferred pick and roll coverage, or do you vary it just based upon personnel?
You know, vary at some, but I have a preferred, and it's a little different. I was showing a few people a couple of years ago. I call it my 45. You know, if you're on a guy and you trap the screen and roll, everybody knows what that is. You jump it, you trap it, you give up the roll, and everybody tries to get the ball out of a good guard's hands, okay? The shack, what we call the shack, is your 2-3 steps back, and all you're doing is you got a center who can't pick and pop, you can't shoot it, so now you're keeping the ball in front of you for the guy to get over, and you're not letting the guy roll behind you. That makes a lot of sense, and it seems to be right. But this day and age, with so many guys that can pick and pop, if we don't want to switch, we'll get a guy up there on a 45-degree angle, try to make the ball handler veer up a little bit, get the guard through, and then get back to our man. So we've probably done more what I call 45 than we have either the shack or the trap.
Jamal, what's your view on pick and roll coverage on a side pick and roll? How do you view it? Do you have a preferred coverage? And then how do you deal with sort of personnel-based decisions?
It's tough. The side pick and roll is the toughest one, one of the toughest ones. So, but our preferred coverage is down, and we call it blue, which is keeping it on the sideline. And then, like coaches have talked about, the shack rule, that big being down the floor. Again, because of the three, because of the penetration, and you're willing to give up the tough two over the layup and the easy rotational three. So we just have our guys force that thing to the sideline, down the sideline, more to the corner. The bigs drop back. And again, with these popping bigs, we end up calling it a late. So if that guard gets downhill and he's attacking that big, then that guard just says, I'm no longer chasing. I'm breaking off to that popping big. And now we're in a switch. But by the time they get the rotation back, you're into the shot clock.
Is that new, Jamal? Because the last couple of years, I watched the NBA go to down, as you call it. And I tried that some, and that's what started happening. You know, they'd be picking and popping guys. And that makes a little more sense. So he's got to pick a point where he says, the hell with it, I'm going back. And that's what he does, huh?
Now,
do guys kind of, well, I thought he was going, so, you know.
There's a lot of gray area with that. Yeah. I think it's gray. So we had to start deciding. We had the discussion. Does the big call it? Does the small call it? It's communication. And a lot of times, if that guard's coming full speed downhill at you, it turns into an automatic, because by the time he throws it back, again, we're probably 12 to 10 on the shot clock, and now they've got to make a decision.
Can I ask you one more thing on that? Where is your rule when you have them shack or turn it down? Where do you put your big? Because I see some teams that put them way back, and then that guard just comes off and snakes it, and then he gets in the lane where you don't want him and I don't want him. Or do you keep him up a little closer? Where do you put your big?
So we're about an arm length and a half away.
Good.
Because if I'm too close, the snake back turns and I can beat the big around the corner. If I'm too far back, it's an easy uncontested shot. So we put him about an arm length and a half away, because now if he does cut it back, I can contest. That guard can go to the big's legs if he rolls, but it's going to be a contested shot one way or the other.
You know, Tom, you've got a little bit longer on the shot clock, obviously, than the NBA does, 30 seconds as opposed to the NBA's 24. So if you are downing or icing a side pick and roll and the ball handler takes it down toward the corner, then throws back to the big, how do you handle that next pass? Are you denying the next pass?
You know, we're not. And that is the problem, you know, that I think the extra 6 seconds, I mean, 6 seconds doesn't seem a lot of time, but I've been with a couple NBA guys in the Goodwill games. I was with Doc Rivers, Flip Saunders, and you know, I'm sitting there and the shot clock's at 5 and I'm panicking, you know, got to have a shot clock, but you got to have something. And they're going, oh, relax, you know, 4 seconds, 3 seconds, boom, somebody does something. We're in college with the 30 seconds, we have more time. So if you take care of the first original one, there's more time to create other problems. So what we're doing is if we down it and he takes it down and they throw back, the next guy should be stunting, we call it. He should be stunting, as Jamal said about getting in the post, you know, keeping him uncomfortable so he doesn't have a ready shoot shot. And the stunting helps a little bit, but sometimes it creates penetration problems. And that's why we vary it between even switching it or not. But side ball screens, to me, are by far the toughest to cover. On top, you know, you can get a little bit more help, make a few more decisions. But boy, on the side, it's tough.
All right, I'm gonna give you a specific situation. You have a switch, and you've got one of your little guys, one of your guards, smallest players, that has to guard a big guy in the post. How do you teach that little guy to guard in the post before he can get switched back out? And Jamal, let's start with you.
Usually, obviously, it happens in the pick and roll. So the first thing I'm telling that guard is, as soon as you're hit in the pick and roll and you realize that you can't fight back through to your guard and you collect the roller, meet him early. So you're doing your work right when, as soon as you've gotten hit, you're standing him up. If it's on the side ball screen, I'm standing him up before he even can get to that block. So now I'm just fighting, battling. As he goes to get the seal, I'm playing behind and I'm swiping, lifting with an under dig on that high side, so he doesn't have a rhythm, you know, to just back you down. He's at least thinking about you stabbing at the basketball. So it's meet him early, don't get buried, and dig at the basketball with whatever hand is not on the back, so he can't just get an easy back down.
Tom, how about you?
Well, we're doing the same thing. We're trying to meet him early and force him out of the block, force him out of the perimeter. Number one, with our help, if we can force him out a step, now it's easier for the wing guy to dig in there a little bit and not lose, you know, sight of the shooter. In the NBA, with that line being back, the distance is so much bigger. That's got to be hard. And if it's not a crazy, you know, like me against Shaq, we'll try to front down there and get some weak side help and tell him, you know, if he's a good scoring post guy, we got to put a lot of pressure on the ball until we can get another switch down low with maybe a wing who's a little bigger.
So when you try the front, are you telling your little guard, sit on his legs?
Yeah, I am. I sit on that knee that he's posting with and just try to physically force him down or force him out. You know, again, with some of the giants in their league, although their league's changing too now, Shaq's aren't as prominent as they were. So physical nature of things isn't as prominent as it was. So, you know, I don't know what I do in that league, but for us, we're just trying to – we played Michigan, and they had a good point guard and a 7-2 guy. And we had Winston, so we double-switched that a lot. It, almost immediately when he hit, went back, he tried to hold him off. Our opposite wing came in, and we just kind of switched it out that way to get around it.
Let me give you another specific situation that there's always a lot of discussion about. And people have differing views. And Tom, start with you in the college game. End of game, you are ahead by three. Your opponent has the ball. What goes into your decision as whether to foul and send your opponent to the free throw line or whether to play it out? What factors do you consider there?
Well, you know, I've been a stubborn guy that for the most of my career, I said my defense is better than their offense, you know. Then I started realizing it's not. So, you know, what I look at a couple of things is, you know, probably how good a free throw shooter he is. But I look more at the rebounding part of it, you know. Are they been dominating us on the boards? Can they get in there? I mean, I know the numbers and the statistics say to do it. But unfortunately, I've gone with a feel, which I'm not sure is the right answer. You know, is it 4 seconds left, 3, 5, 7, you know. Everybody says it. Well, it goes part that. And I respect the guys that say, once it gets under 7, I'm fouling no matter what. You know, Judd Heathcote, who I work for, and I think it depends on your experience and what's happened to you. We lost a couple games at the buzzer up 1, and a guy made a shot. So back when we had Steve Smith and guys like that, if there were 10 seconds left and we were up 1, sometimes we'd foul. Because he'd say, I'm going to put the hands to Scott Skiles or Steve Smith, the ball in his hands instead of the other way around. So I've seen a lot of people kind of grow from what they've been through. I think the NBA deals with more statistical information than we do in college, and it's probably coming that way. But I'm starting to go more to fouling and thinking that still a couple things have to happen. You have to make the first one. You have to miss the second one. You have to get the rebound, and you have to get a shot. So it makes sense. I'm just
and just to follow up, and that's all assuming that your players are going to execute it the way you would like, yes. And the officials are going to call it the way you would like. So in other words, if you tell a player to go out and foul, and they foul once the opponent gets into a shooting motion, or the officials don't call the foul when you want them to, and they'll only call it when it gets to a shooting motion, there's additional risk to consider there, because it's not in college, it's not seen as often as it is in the NBA by the officials. Is that fair?
Well, you can, in the NBA, you can kind of grab a guy a little bit more, right? I mean, in college, you can't really do that. And I think that is fair. And everybody says, well, you got to practice it. Well, that'd be fine if we had the same official at every game, you know, but I don't want to blame the officials, because I do that for 30 games a year. So we're in the summer now. I don't want to blame those damn guys. But the truth of it is, they screw up too, you know, and sometimes the act of shooting depends if there's 15,000 people in the crowd or 700, you know, whoever the home team is. So that's knocking the officials. I shouldn't do that. But it is true. There's a lot of different things that have to happen. And that's why for a long time I relied on my defense, but I'm changing a little bit. Jamal,
how do you view it? How do you view that on the NBA level? When do you foul? Is it under five? How do you look at it?
I'm similar to Coach Izzo. And like you said, there's so many scenarios where is your team going to execute it and how do you work on it? But initially, I was never a foul guy. I didn't like it. I thought playing it out was the best thing. And then, you know, we get in a couple of situations and scenarios here where you have to, you know, because guys are too good. You have to work on how you foul. You have to work on is his back turned? Is he facing me? Because you see how Luka gets shots up, you know, after the buzzer, you know, and they count them. So you got to know, like you're saying, with the officiating, who you have. I'm a believer in fouling more now than anything because of that. Because now, you know, play the clock, play the free throw, play the percentages in some ways. And it's probably five and under, I'm fouling. Or, you know, you just give up the layup and then, you know, just you get the ball back. That kind of way.
Well, Jamal, one of the great resources there is in the game, and I am a subscriber. I get the emails every day and look at all the videos, even though I don't have a team. But eCoach, I know you've been active in eCoach. Can you talk a little bit about that as a resource and how important that is, for especially for young coaches?
Oh, eCoach has been fantastic. I just realized that they just have such a tie-in and connection with the NBA and teaching the game from the fundamental standpoints of it. And it's a so wide-ranging of things that you can just click on and realize what you have. If you have a problem, you know, you want to figure out how to do closeouts, we have that. If you want to figure out how to do ball screens, they have that. It's been such a great resource. And it's been great for our coaches to do it, too, to keep that connection going with eCoach and the junior NBA and the NBA as well.
Well, Tom, as things are beginning to open up, whether it's phase one or phase two in different states, college sports and the NBA are getting back to business in as safe a way as possible. How are things going forward for you at Michigan State, and how are things looking for you?
Well, we're bringing our kids in a week to start the first phase, which will be testing and this and that. And then getting to the weight room, coaches aren't going to be able to touch them for a while. But I think the NBA is important to us, because I think we're going to look at what they do and try to figure out the things they do. Just like, I hate to say it, but the NBA kind of started the COVID, meaning once it happened in Utah, you know, everybody got shut down. I'm hoping that the NBA can bring it back too, by showing how we can do it safely and get it going. But it's both for me. I mean, I think kids need some time off. Some of these kids have had AAU ball since they were 10. And I think you're going to find that some of them needed the time off. But how they come back, what kind of shape they're in, and how we can get them to the level. I'm surprised that the NBA isn't playing for like 6 weeks from when they made this decision. But I also understand it, because you can't have injuries. You can't have things that could create problems. And so hopefully they get to do it the right way. For us, we don't play until November, hopefully. So I think it gives us a good chance to gradually get into it.
Jamal, how are things looking for you with the restart? And obviously good news that the NBA is looking to start in Orlando in July. But the ramp up, what is that looking like for you and for your team?
Well, for us, I mean, Mark's done a great job of, you know, keeping things, make sure they're safe and done the right way. And so that we're following the NBA protocol, what they've given us on how we can come in, when we can do individual workouts. So it's ramping up very, it's slowly, but it's getting guys in conditioning first to avoid injury, the testing that they do very safely as they come in. So it's moving piece by piece as what, you know, the NBA has given us the protocol to do. So it's not, we're not trying to get ahead of schedule. It's everything's very fluid. So we're just trying to keep with the same order that they've given us to do it to keep everyone safe.
Well, you guys both look great. I hope you stay safe and healthy, your families and your teams, and best of luck as things get started again. And it was great to have both of you with us. Thanks for joining us on Junior NBA Coaches Corner, especially two accomplished players, Jamal at Colorado and Tom Izzo at Northern Michigan, the Division II All-American, 1977. Go look it up if you can find it.
You got to check on that rock you were talking about. It's in there.
Thank you.
Hey, Jamal, it was great being with you. So someday get a head job. I will retire, come work for you. And Jay, thanks. You were great.
I would love it. I'll put your defensive rebounding drill in.
You're going to bring your pads for that.
Thank you.
You guys be good.
All right. Take care. See ya.
For more coaching resources, including our curriculum, please visit juniornba.com. I want to thank our friends at the NBA Coaches Association and eCoach for providing instructional content from their eCoach basketball video library to give our viewers an insider's perspective about how NBA coaches teach the topic we're focusing upon each week. For more information and to access the coaches video library, go to eCoachBasketball.com.
Thanks for listening. Make sure to join Jay each week for the Junior NBA Coaches Corner. Go to juniornba.com or wherever your favorite podcasts are found.